Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Candidate Trump said he would end the Ukraine conflict in 24 hours. Well, he's now president-elect. Time to keep that promise. The problem is Washington and Moscow have radically different ideas about peace and security. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Karen Kwiatkowski, in Mount Jackson. She is a retired U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel, having served at both NSA and the Office of Secretary of Defense. In London, we have Ian Proud. He is a senior British diplomat and author of Misfit in Moscow, How British Diplomacy in Russia Failed. And in Kyoto, we cross to Pascal Lotas. He is an associate professor at Kyoto University. All right, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Before we talk about a supposed Trump peace plan, I'd like to get your reaction from all three of you about the recent spate of appointments that Trump is going to bring into his administration. Karen, I mean, I know that, you know, it could, you, some people like Coke, some people like Pepsi, but it's still cola. And then that's my feeling here. Karen.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, he's got a mix of neocons that we recognize, extremely pro-Israel appointments. And then combined with that, he has some of the people like Tulsi Gabbard, who have been tremendous critics of what's been going on for the past couple decades. So we have a mix.
Okay. Ian, how about you? Because, I mean, one could say this is all by design, is that there'll be a lot of infighting. Maybe that's what Trump wants. No one will have hegemony. They'll all have to look to him as the mediator. I mean, you've been in bureaucracies before. What's your read on this?
Well, the obvious conclusion I've drawn is that Trump's attention is very much turning towards what's happening in the Middle East and also what's happening in China and Taiwan, and therefore focus on Ukraine and support for the war effort there is going to be on a steady decline, much as he said in his election campaign.
And Pascal, I mean, he stressed during the campaign and even his victory speech that he's a man that he wants to create peace and wars. With this lot coming in here, they don't seem very peace-driven to me, Pascal.
No, and I agree. Candace Owens, one of those famous news anchors in the U.S., she already put out an emergency message to Trump saying, like, you're being subverted by the lesser-known neocons in the U.S., and that's what's happening. So instead of having neocons that are focused on the U.S.-Ukraine war, you have neocons who are focused on Iran and on China, and apparently these are the people that he will appoint, and I don't know whether he knows about that or not, but it seems that John Mearsheimer's prediction is coming true, that the blob always wins out.
Yes, it would seem to be the case here. You can change the president, but the hegemonic tendencies are almost impossible to reverse. Okay, let's talk about peace plans here. Karen, there's leaks all over the place. There are rumors about what Trump may propose. I don't think he has a clue of what he wants to do. But there seems to be a lot of people, I'm thinking about this fake telephone call between Trump and Putin, that's trying to divert our attention or make us assume about certain dynamics of a deal. There can be no deal if there's no common understanding about security. And that's the crux of the problem here. Karen.
Yeah, that's true. But the common understanding of the Ukraine situation, he does have some people in place that get that. Certainly, I mentioned Tulsi Gabbard, but J.D. Vance also gets it very well. He's followed Ukraine, so he understands. If Trump delegates to some of these people to push Ukraine off of his front burner, which is what he intends to do, then we are going to see compromise. We are going to see talks, communication, and it's going to be based on what's actually happened. So I'm hopeful in that regard. But as you said, with the turn, the neocon attitude towards China and the Middle East, we see this persisting. But I will say this. The D.C. establishment is enraged. They are enraged and they are frightened, and that has got to be a good sign.
It's got to be a good sign. I agree. In the talk is it's focusing on a ceasefire. Now, I can understand why the Ukrainians would want that. They're losing. I can understand how Washington feels that way, because that will give them a breather. But that, a ceasefire simply is not in the cards. But all of the punditry on cable TV is talking about a ceasefire. This is done intentionally. It's trying to determine the parameters of what some talks could be, which it's a non-starter for Moscow. Ian?
Well, the fighting has to stop, and that is technically what a ceasefire is. But actually what there needs to be is an actual kind of plan for delivering the peace. Now, Vladimir Putin's spoken about going back to the March 2022 Istanbul Agreement. That seems to be a good place for negotiations to start. But as part of that process of actually having a peace plan, the fighting does actually need to end because, as you say, Ukraine is losing on the battlefield. So I think actually that the two aren't mutually exclusive. Fighting has to stop, but also there does need to be a longer-term plan. That needs to recognise Russia's critical national security interests. You know, a final reckoning with the whole kind of NATO issue is a big one. Another key area for discussion is what happens with sanctions as that peace plan unfolds.
Yeah, Pascal, again, when I look at inside baseball foreign policy, they're all kind of gravitating to a new Minsk agreement, which Minsk 1 and 2 failed because the Western powers failed to fulfill it. Russia's not going to buy a Minsk 3.
No, and Russia shouldn't buy a Minsk 3, but at the same time, Russia still has an interest to find some sort of way out, because the danger right now is that Russia might win the war, but lose the peace. And not losing the peace, not losing what comes next, has to be top priority. And unless Russia is willing to swallow Ukraine whole, which would include the entire Western part of Ukraine, which would be a poisonous pill, that would be a really, really difficult thing to achieve, or impossible. So there needs to be a settlement, a piece of paper that is signed by everybody in order to get to a next stage, which implies that there need to be negotiations, which implies that something's got to give from the side of NATO, but also from the side of Russia. And that's going to be very tough on Russia, I believe, because there is going to be hard bargaining still involved, unless you want to go for all-out occupation.
Yeah, I hear you. I don't think the complete occupation of Ukraine has ever been in the cards. I mean, that would be just something untenable. And it wouldn't garner any benefits for Russia in the short or long term. Karen, one of the issues here also is, can Russia trusts the next administration? I mean, under Trump, Trump was a Russian agent, the hoax. But, I mean, Trump was harder on Russia than any other American president. I mean, where's the trust? And I want to ask Ian that, because he's a former diplomat. Go ahead, Karen.
Yeah, there's no trust. And the idea of Minsk, of course, was ruined because the guarantor was Germany, which admitted that this whole thing was a hoax to begin with. So there's no trust. I don't think any NATO country could really be trusted to oversee this. And the Trump administration is, by its very nature, it's kind of reactive. It's kind of, it's not completely clear where it's going. It is not necessarily trustworthy in terms of this. So who is going to help bring these two countries together, bring, you know, Ukraine and Russia together? And the other thing is, who are they going to deal with? You know, for a long time, Zelensky said, I will not deal with Putin. I will never deal with Putin. And now Zelensky isn't even a legitimate leader anymore. You know, he's an effective dictator, and no country can effectively negotiate with that guy because he doesn't have legal legitimacy as a leader. So we have big problems. And I think one of the things they'll look at is, will Zelensky be replaced with someone that can trust some agency and can come to some sort of settlement?
Same question to you, Ian. I mean, the level of trust, that's the first step to the first hurdle, as it were, here. I can tell you that the level of trust from here, looking at the West, it's zero. I mean, you've got to make me a deal. You guys have to come up with something that can be credible, because your record is deplorable. And that's objectively true. That's just not my opinion. Go ahead, Ian.
No, I agree. And actually, back in 2014, before things got really, really bad, a contact and friend of mine in the Russian presidential administration, she told me that actually all the trust had gone and it would take a decade to restore trust. And that was in 2014. So the amount of time it'll take to kind of really restore trust on both sides, and particularly on the Russian side, you know, trusting us and vice versa, will be a very long time coming, 10 years, possibly more. But we still have to deal with each other in the here and now. If I go back briefly on the Minsk agreement, so I slightly kind of take a different view from Karen, having been up close and personal to what was happening in real time on Minsk. Minsk II agreement fell apart because the Americans and the British didn't want it to work. And actually, that they really kind of conspired to kind of put sanctions in place and make Minsk subordinate to the sanctions policy, effectively making sanctions against Russia permanent. You know, the US government was never invested in Minsk. In fact, was invested in ensuring that Minsk, you know, II failed. And that's indeed what happened. I think what, you know, that what is materially different now is that if the US administration gets behind some sort of new peace plan, there'll be a greater level of investment in it. When it comes to actual trust, yes, you're right that kind of relations between Russia and the US collapsed during the previous Trump administration, you know, weapon supplies to Ukraine, undermining the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, the sort of things that Trump talked about on the campaign trail. But that was largely down to the dynamics on the Hill in DC itself. Actually, Trump did have a rapport with Putin, even throughout all of those difficult times, met and spoke with Putin. And there was a level of rapport and trust with a small T between the two of them, which means that they can actually trade and discuss and cut deals, but
right now, Ian, I'll stay with Ian before we go to the break here. I mean, diplomacy was criminalized under Biden. How do we get away from that?
Well, yeah, I 100% agree with you. I mean, Biden never spoke to Putin once, you know, from the point of the war starting. Actually, diplomacy was effectively criminalized on the UK side as well. It has been for over a decade. Yeah. But actually what people like Vance and Trump are saying is that, you know, we have to engage, we have to talk. You know, Trump was saying he has a good relationship with Putin.
We'll see. All right, I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a hard break. And after that hard break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaVelch. Remind you, we're discussing Ukraine. Okay, let's go back to Pascal in Kyoto. One of the things that worries me in this interim period here, it obviously impacts what's going on in Ukraine, but also in the greater Middle East, the issue of escalation. I've asked around, it seems to be a split decision. I tend to think that the Biden administration will escalate before Trump could come in to de-escalate, if that is his plan here. But escalation can create political facts on the ground that the next administration just has to inherit. And I think we saw how Obama tripped up Trump when he was coming into office in 2017. I don't know why Biden wouldn't want to trip up Trump before January. Go ahead, Pascal.
I'm a little bit less worried about that one, because by now it seems as if though the Pentagon put a hard stop on the idea of strikes inside pre-2022 Russian territory, and that it is the Pentagon that actually calls the shots on these decisions.
Pascal, would that apply to the British and the French and others in NATO?
I see that this is an option that could happen, but I honestly think that if the Americans say don't do it, they won't, because they are on the short, they are on the leash. So, and it's only 2 months from now. Even the Germans, who have like these elections coming up, and Mr. Merz, who might come in, he even for his closest day to do anything is like February or March. I think it's too little time to do anything that stupid, although maybe I'm underestimating.
I think you are definitely underestimating. Definitely, I think. Who knows? Maybe we'll have a November surprise or a December surprise. Karen, I have an idea. And, you know, because I obviously want this conflict to end, because this conflict never should have started in the first place. There were so many ways to avoid it. And I want to ask all three of you this. What about another Helsinki 2.0, and a pan-European security approach? And so, instead of just focusing on Ukraine, you focus on the entire picture. And by doing that, you can solve that problem that's in the center of it all. I know it's ambitious. If I told Donald Trump this, he probably would go for it because he could get a Nobel Prize. But this is the only way forward, because this is the only way to where everybody gets the terms and conditions of security. Everybody lines that up. The rest of it can follow. Go ahead, Karen.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great idea. That is a wonderful idea. But the problem we have is NATO.
Well, that's their problem. Okay, my opinion. Go ahead.
Yeah. It's a good idea. But when you mention Nobel Prizes, you have to remember Obama also got one.
Well, but that's why Trump wants one. Okay.
Oh, good point. Good point.
Well, Ian, let me throw that to you. I mean, you're an experienced diplomat. I mean, it's a bold idea, a lot of moving pieces here, but the goal is very specific: security for everyone. And I think that's the best way to approach this. Go ahead, Ian.
Yeah, and of course, the problem is that both the European Union and the NATO grouping have departed from that kind of wider multilateralism, actually. And you see what's happening in Ukraine, but also in the Middle East, is representative of a type of diplomacy and foreign policy in which Western powers want to pick sides in the conflict between one side and the other side. Now, that is completely incompatible with some wider multilateral approach where the security of every state is indivisible. And so unless you can kind of break that essential kind of bilateralism, plurilateralism, which kind of dominates, you know, where NATO and where EU kind of foreign policy is at, you won't be able to kind of get to that point. And in any case, you know, that is being overtaken by what's happening through, for example, the BRICS movement, where they are actually leading that debate, you know, on security kind of writ large in the absence of engagement by Western powers.
Well, Pascal, again, Helsinki 2.0. What's wrong with that idea? Karen's absolutely right, is that NATO wouldn't like it. But because of NATO, we have this conflict in Ukraine. And so that has to be dealt with here. But if you approaching the bigger picture may be the way forward, and face-saving for everyone involved.
Absolutely. I mean, you're totally right. Helsinki 2.0 is exactly what we need. But the sad matter of the fact is that the people in charge at the moment, the elites in the European capitals and in Washington, don't want that. I'm not sure about Washington anymore, because the change might actually, Trump and Vance might want to go for that, but I'm not sure the blob does. The thing is that a neutral Ukraine would have been a Helsinki 2.0. The thing is that in December 2021, Russia asked for a Helsinki 2.0 with its draft treaties that it sent over. Russia has asked time and again to create a common security structure, and time and again it was rebuffed. And it's really, really horrible. But if we look at it in the terms of the Cold War, we always had ups and downs where people were like more willing to actually do common, mutually beneficial agreements and less times. And right now we're in a time where they are less likely to do that, because right now the Europeans are not able to think of a mutually beneficial solution. They think that anything that is good for Russia is necessarily bad for us, and anything good for us and it must be bad for Russia, therefore there's no common ground. It is that stupid, but unfortunately we are in that kind of mindset, and unless we get out of that mindset, there's not going to be a win-win solution, which we need, which Helsinki 2.0 would be.
Well, Karen, the indivisibility of security was a term that was used quite often during the Cold War. That was the very basis of the Helsinki process. I can remember after the special military operation started, Russia was talking about the indivisibility of security, and the U.S. State Department acted like it had never heard the term.
They probably hadn't. we haven't had a diplomat in the American government for some time.
And I guess we won't have one for a while, too. Keep going.
Yeah, no, I mean, if it's true that they're putting Rubio in as Secretary of State, and I don't know if that's true or not, but that means that it'll all go back to Trump. If Trump wants something, he'll try to negotiate it. And it's not clear what Trump really, if Trump thinks in these same terms that we're talking about today. But another issue you have to look at is the money. You know, Ukraine has been a dump for money, and many people have been profiting from this war. People on this end, you know, U.S., but also European companies and other states that are close by. And, you know, they have that money's drying up. The war is ending. There's not enough Ukrainians left to die. We've pretty much this project has destroyed the people of Ukraine. So the investment potential is really drying up rapidly. And the money people who really drive both the neocons and the rest of government, which I'm not sure how much is left after the neocons, but whatever, we have this government's driven by money. It's driven by the big investors and what they hope to get from something. So they're going to be a factor here that we're not talking about, which is going to accelerate the decision to stop this thing. There's no financial benefit to continuing it. And that sounds very cold, because all the dead people, all the destruction of the environment, the terrible, just the refugee problem, everything, all of this driven by the money people in many ways.
Yeah, well, you know, let me go to Ian here. I mean, war is awful, obviously, here, but what has been done to Ukraine is a crime, because this shouldn't have happened. There were ways around this, okay? This was a conflict that was wanted by Washington, I would say by London as well, because of their misperceptions of Russia's abilities and whatnot here. But even as they think about any kind of a peace plan, Ukraine doesn't really play a big role in it. That's, again, it's really quite pathetic. Go ahead, Ian.
Yeah, Ukraine is becoming a holiday economically state that's become massively depopulated, overburdened with huge amounts of debt, despite the kind of billions it's received in free aid, you know, from the West. You know, it's becoming like an empty, dysfunctional shell and a failed state. Whereas the Western powers carry on, you know, as normal. They increasingly focus on their own kind of domestic concerns, you know, as in fact does Russia. So, you know, the only sort of people really to have suffered from this are Ukrainian people in the big scheme of things. And, you know, if we really care about, you know, Ukraine's future choices, then the best way to do that would be to end the war, you know, tomorrow, as Trump has promised to do.
Well, Pascal, considering the potential, we don't, you know, none of these people have power now, but the names that are being bandied about, will you think that there will be a big struggle within the Trump administration on how to move forward? Or maybe, you know, Trump says he has an idea. It was a good campaign slogan as policy. Now, you know, it's crunch time here. But, I mean, with the collective wisdom, if these people have any wisdom at all, is that what he's going to rely upon?
And that's very good people, good analysts in this administration now. I mean, J.D. Vance has proven time and again with his talks and with his book that he actually has some clue of what is going on. Tulsi Gabbard and others have done so too. But as in every administration, you're going to have different a variety of opinion. And unfortunately, right now, what we are seeing is that Mr. Trump is appointing more and more people who we know who are neocons, who we know are in the zero-sum game kind of thinking. And they are unfortunately now probably going to be a majority, and they can count on having people in the back who think like them as well in the bureaucracy. And unless that changes, unless the reasonable people can override those guys, I see that the current way forward is going to have a harder time of going forward, and maybe we're going to see some change when it comes to Ukraine. That's the biggest chance for change, but not for Iran and not for China. This one is going to probably continue. The Titanic is going to continue to drive toward that iceberg when it comes to these two, which is sad.
Karen, do you think that this time next year we'll be talking about Trump's peace plan?
I would like to think that proposed and implemented, and that war is over. You know, it occurs to me, too, with the way that Trump is putting his appointments forward, the really smart people that he is putting into the various positions are not neocons. And the really stupid people, and I think I'm being objective here, the stupid people, Rubio, okay, not too bright, Some of these others, the guy they're putting in for the DOD, not very experienced, very reactive, not exceptionally bright. So these guys are fodder to be fired later.
Well, Karen, we can end on this note. I mean, personnel is policy, after all. We'll see how it unfolds here. The good thing is people are talking about ending the war. That's good. Okay, I want to thank my guests in London, Kyoto, and in Mount Jackson. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk Rules.